You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Thursday morning. It is September 16th. I think it was supposed to be yesterday when the House and the Senate had a soft deadline to write their reconciliation bills, which I don't believe has been fully met. I know the committees have done various votes. So I don't think we don't have a singular bill yet.
They're not even in session, are they?
Well, I think the House in full is not in session, but the committees are still doing work.
Okay.
But we did have a game-changing development in the reconciliation process when Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went to the Met Ball and wore a dress. That changed the game, right?
Are you being sarcastic?
Yeah, I'm being sarcastic.
Okay. Well, a lot to unpack here. So first, there's the hypocrisy, right, of going to a hoity-toity event. And it's one thing to go to it, you know, if you're a champion of the poor and you know, concerned about income inequality. But she wants to get to go to the ball and get to claim to be a hero by wearing this dress, right? And so she gets to kind of have her cake and eat it too. She gets to go to a cool ball, be celebrated for being this like champion of the downtrodden simultaneously. And I think there's some question as to whether you can accept a gift. It's like $30,000, I think, is the price of admission to that event. But what's your take on this, Bill?
Well, I'm pro fun. I'm pro parties. You know, I was never a sourpuss about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I don't think you're a bad person if you're on the left and you're invited to a nice event. You get to go. I don't think that makes you a hypocrite. You don't have to live like a pauper to be on the left. So I don't think she's a bad person for going, and I don't think she's a bad person for wearing something that makes, you know, a statement. I mean, I think people are allowed to make statements. You know, people have free speech. I don't think that, again, I don't think that makes her a bad person. What I do think is, I mean, keep in mind this, we're in the same week, this week, there was a proposal that Biden had that congressional Democrats were fine-tuning to apply capital gains tax to heirs of wealthy estates. And the House Ways and Means Committee, at the end of the day, decided not to put that provision in their bill. Now, maybe it can live another day somehow, but it seems hard.
This is part of the reconciliation.
Right. And part of the process here is figuring out what are the revenue raisers going to be to pay for the big ticket items that progressives want, and you're having moderate pushback on some of the revenue raisers. And if they can hold down if you raise less revenue and you're saying this has to be paid for, then you can do less things on the spending side. So my overarching point here is that, I think there are reasons why that one provision didn't end up in the Ways and Means portion of the bill. I'm happy to get into those wonky details later. My point is, just saying tax the rich doesn't help you tax the rich. Like, it is far more complicated. Tax law is a far more complicated legislative minefield. I think there are reasons why this one provision didn't make it into the bill. I'm happy to get into that wonky discussion later, but I think it is evidence that if you want to tax the rich, it's a lot more complicated than just saying tax the rich. It's one thing if you're a year out from the legislative process and you're trying to build up some momentum for taxing the rich. You're in the middle of the game. You're in the middle of the sausage making. you know, the hard work is being done right now, and there are special interests swooping on Capitol Hill. There's lobbyists everywhere trying to get into the weeds of the bill and make it more favorable to them. And wearing a slogan on a dress is not a very effective tactic to withstanding that kind of pressure. So I don't think she's a hypocrite. I don't think she has mastered the game inside the halls of Congress. And people who
thought... I don't think she wants to. Well, I don't think she cares. I think I think there's a sort of pro-AOC argument and an anti-AOC argument here, right? So the pro-AOC argument is she doesn't actually care about winning a short-term legislative battles. She wants to change the culture. She wants to make it cool to be a progressive or a socialist and to want to tax the rich. And then she's achieving that. She's accomplishing that. She's making it glamorous and sexy and you know, like Vanity Fair to be this. Let me give you the criticism, which is that she's brilliant at self-promotion and manipulating the media and getting attention for herself. And that's the real goal.
Well, I don't think you should begrudge any politician trying to attract attention, because that is how you accumulate power and influence to get things done. So that to me is not
to
a negative.
To what end?
Well, to what end is a legitimate question. But I think that's like I would put that critique much more on, say, a Madison Cawthorn, who doesn't seem to be about doing anything of substance. I mean, AOC wants to do certain things. She does have policy goals she wants to achieve. And so the fact that she can garner attention for herself in order to achieve those goals, that to me is not – that's not evidence of weakness. That's evidence of strength that she can do that much. I do think she has not developed mastery of the inside game, which right now is really the important skill.
Okay, but – I would say that – I guess the point I'm making is that AOC is like Madison Cawthorn or was it Matt Gaetz who said, like, if you're not getting on TV, you're not legislating or something to that effect in Vanity Fair. I think that there is a trend amongst AOC and Madison Cawthorn and Matt Gaetz that this new generation, that it's about image and attention and publicity, and they don't really care that much about getting in the weeds and making the sausage or whatever the analogy is. And maybe to a certain degree, they're right in terms of becoming celebrities themselves. But I think the question is, are they right in terms of changing the narrative in the long term? Maybe they have a point.
Well, I think in the case of AOC and Tax the Rich is already very popular. You know, she's not fighting an uphill battle as far as the narrative is concerned. Tax the Rich has been a popular thing in polls for decades. It was popular when Democrats in 2009 won with Obama on the heels of the Bush tax cuts. But they still hesitated to repeal the Bush tax cuts in 2010, because once the rubber hit the road, it was going to negatively impact certain people in certain states, in certain districts, that made them nervous about reelection. So I have a piece in the queue at the monthly that gets into this. In 2010, you had Barbara Boxer and Patty Murray. These are not moderates, but they repped West Coast states, blue states, with a good number of very wealthy liberals. And they were nervous about going into the 2010 midterm having jacked up people's taxes. And this is also in the middle of the recession still. So Harry Reid didn't put that on the floor, even though there was a strategy memo by James Carville and Stan Greenberg, two big Democratic operatives, saying, look, the polls show this is a favorable issue for Democrats. The polls show Democrats have an 18-point margin on repealing the Bush tax cuts, at least in part. This is one of your strongest issues. You should lean into this. But what makes sense in the aggregate doesn't always make sense, you know, at the micro level. So to get down to like this particular case right now with the capital gains tax, so-called step up in basis, where right now, if you are, you have an estate and you die, your heirs don't pay capital gains tax at the point of death. They can push it off for later when there's an actual, forgive me for botching this. I think when there's an actual, you know, sale of the asset. And Biden was saying, no, it's not the sale of the asset. It's at the point of the inheritance, the point of death. And we're also going to raise the rate on that tax to boot. Although they, now that generated the typical, anti-death tax argument. Oh, what about the poor family farmer? You know, this is not just going to hit these mega wealthy people, these family assets they want to pass down their, generation to generation. They're going to be caught up in this. And then we said, okay, we'll do an exemption. We'll do an exemption for the first $5 million of the asset for a single or $10 million for a couple. That really should, you know, this is not about the Humley family farmer anymore. And, you know, Jonathan Chait had a big piece in New York Magazine, how Heidi Heitkamp, who the former Democratic senator from North Dakota, 6 months ago, and this is actually covered first by Alex Sam at the American Prospect, 6 months ago said, this is a total scam. This is a giant loophole. We got to get rid of this. All of a sudden, she's fronting a nonprofit funded by dark money saying this is terrible for family farmers and small business owners. And she got her on the phone saying, look, there's an exemption here. What are you complaining about? And she was like, well, even if there is an exemption, people don't believe it. And so it's bad politics. And this drove Chait up the wall. Like, well, it's because people like you are telling him.
This is like when that's like when Ted Cruz said that we, because people thought the election was stolen, that we had to like postpone certification or something. Do you remember that story?
Yeah.
Because people thought, and it's like, well, people think it's stolen because you say, you know, people like you.
But here's a more charitable explanation for that. Okay. Because the Wall Street Journal had a piece about, people in Abigail Spanberger's district, Central Virginia, some big farms there. And she went on tour meeting with constituents and she heard concern about this provision and they talked to one, owner of a horse breeding farm. So now if you're in a horse breeding farm, and I don't know this guy's exact situation, I'm guessing he's not a poor, humble family farmer. A horse breeding farm is usually a pretty upscale operation. Nevertheless, constituent of owner. And he said, you know, stepped up in basis, you know, once you give, if you start messing with that, get rid of that, you know, that's really going to make, you know, family farmers very nervous. And think about it this way. You could tell somebody, look, I'm crafting this bill that's not going to affect you. And I don't even know how big this family farm is, if it would qualify under the exemption or not. You can say, look, here's the legislation. Here's the letter of the law. It's not going to affect you. Well, how can you say for sure it's not going to affect me when you change the law next year, the year after that? Mm-hmm. You've now, you know, meddled with the principle.
I think that's a legitimate argument. That's not a bogus, like, red herring or something. Like, that is a legitimate concern. Because once you establish the premise that you can do something,
exactly,
then it's a matter of details that we're quibbling about.
Exactly. And mind you, tax laws are more easily changed because they qualify for budget reconciliation. They are filibuster proof, which is why Democrats raised a lot of taxes under the Obama administration, actually not through reconciliation. And then the Trump Republicans changed that through reconciliation. Democrats are going to change a whole bunch of the Trump stuff this year around. And of course, it was changed under the Bush administration before Obama. And that was through reconciliation. And Clinton tax changes through reconciliation. So tax laws change. So on one hand, on the constituent side, you don't know how much things are going to change more in the future. So any assurances, are hard to convey. And on the politician side, why am I sticking my neck out for a controversial provision that could well get undone 4 years later? Mm-hmm. So And you still may say, well, who cares about this horse farmer? Yeah. This guy is not the median voter. This is not what the majority of people want. This is still someone who's probably doing very well for himself. And
dressage equestrians for Bush. Romney. Sorry, Romney.
But if you're a congressperson in a swing district, you're trying to maintain a 50% plus one coalition of some sort. If you create any small class of angry voters, you are running the risk of weakening your coalition. So it may be that generally speaking, people are fine with it. But if you got, 5,000 people who have long memories because you directly hurt them, that's one chink in your armor. Yeah. So this is why the sausage making is so hard. And I'm not saying Democrats have to throw up their hands and say, well, I guess we can't do anything here, but you've got to get into that. You got to get into those trenches. If you're going to figure out how to navigate, I mean, it's a minefield. It's a literal minefield. There's every tax change has a winner and a loser. And if you add up enough losers, Democrats are going to have a political problem. This is why tax reform is just an inherently hard thing to do. And it's not solved with address. That's my overarching point.
Yes. And a point I've made many times is that, people who may seem to be rich, and I know like Democrats say, we're only going after people who make over $5 million a year, but it doesn't always seem to work out that way. There are a lot of people who seem rich who are actually not rich. Like they've got, debt, or they live in an expensive area. They may have high income, but that doesn't really mean that they're rich. They could be living paycheck to paycheck. They could have investments in, I don't know, horses, So I think sometimes people, especially who live, maybe in the middle of the country, don't realize that some of these like fat cats aren't really so fat. Necessarily.
Yeah, that's a very, blue state limousine liberal argument for you to make, Matt Lewis. But this is also part of the whole SALT debate going on right now, where you have a handful of congresspeople, New York, New Jersey, California, generally speaking, saying we want to get that state and local tax deduction back because we live in higher tax states. And this is unfair that our constituents are getting penalized. And a lot of progressives, even though this was cut under the Trump tax reform bill, but there was a faction of progressives that were cheering it on saying, yeah, screw these upper middle class, New Yorkers and New Jerseyites and Californians, they should pay higher taxes. But there may be enough of them in the Democratic Party, that they could say, look, you can't pass this reconciliation bill unless you give us some kind of relief on SALT, perhaps repeal the entire thing, repeal the entire cap. These little debates are happening right now. There's a lot of focus on Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. But more of the action right now, probably because the House are the people who are actually drafting the bill. The Senate isn't doing a lot of drafting at the moment. The first vote's going to be in the House. The committee votes are happening in the House. You have individual people in different districts with different geographic or demographic concerns, causing problems. We have this issue with drug pricing. Empowering Medicare to negotiate with lower drug prices, and you had three Democrats, and I think it was Ways and Means. Forgive me if I'm getting the committee wrong. That said, no, we're not going to do it, and that could not pass the committee level. Although the provision passed in a different committee, so it still might end up on the floor. But if those three say, "Look, we're not going to vote for this whole thing over this issue," that puts the whole bill in jeopardy. I think they can lose three, but not four. And so you have Democrats saying these people are under the thumb of Big Pharma, the pharma lobby. They've been bought and paid for. And maybe that's true. I actually don't know what's going on in their districts on this score. Is there some pharmaceutical company in their district that they have to look out for? Not just for the fat cat CEOs, but for the workers in these industries. Cause the argument against, Medicare being able to play hardball with the pharmaceuticals is that if the pharmaceuticals take too big of a hit, then they can't innovate. That's the argument that they give. Of course, progressives would say that's a bogus argument. These guys are tons of cash. They can cough up a little bit more, but that's the argument. And they may be more sensitive to the argument if you're in a district with a big pharmaceutical company into it. So you know, these are the tough battles happening right now. And it does make me skeptical that this is going to get resolved in short order. And you do have this September 27th deadline when the bipartisan infrastructure bill is scheduled to come to be for a vote in the House. And all likelihood, reconciliation is not going to be done by then.
Yeah. And you could see how this big $3.5 trillion thing, if it does get done in a sort of slapdash fashion, could have consequences, either political consequences, angering portions of the Democratic coalition, upsetting people, or, you know, substantive, whether that's something like sparking inflation. It could be down the road. You know, look how fast that we were able to develop vaccines, you know, I guess based partially on the profit motive.
Also government funding. Government funding played a big part there.
So you could see how when you start to try to push through something this big and sort of cumbersome and just pack in things quickly and meet this deadline, you know, you could have substantive problems and political problems.
Well, that's why, you know, almost every Democrat has the ability to slow it down. And several are, not just Manchin, not just Sinema. Different pockets, different places for different provisions are throwing their red flags and seeing what kind of leverage they can accrue to shape the bill. And yes. I could not tell you how this is all going to shake out, how much these moderates are going to be able to hold down the amount of revenue that will be raised, which then has direct impact on how much spending they can do and how many new initiatives they can put in the bill. It strikes me as being pretty early in that process.
So what does that mean for the bipartisan bill? Like it sounds to me like you think September 27th is probably not going to happen for the reconciliation bill.
Correct.
What happens to the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is already passed the Senate, right?
It's passed the Senate. So the question is, can it pass the House as is without any changes and go straight to Biden's desk? Will the House pass it? Will Pelosi send it? if Pelosi sends it, then it becomes law within 10 days, whether Biden signs it or not. So the question is, would Pelosi pass it on? And it's hard to predict because you certainly have, I believe on record, 10 or 11 Democrats in the House saying there's no way we're going to pass the bipartisan bill if the Senate hasn't passed the reconciliation bill. The one reason why I say 10 or 11 is I think one of those 11 actually said the House has to pass it first, not the Senate. Minor point. But it's very possible the House wouldn't even pass reconciliation by then. So if those 11 follow through on their stated commitment, you know, AOC and Pramila Jayapal have suggested that the number is bigger than that, but we don't have hard numbers beyond those 11 who put it on record. If they follow through, and I assume they would, I don't know how many Republicans are going to come on board to offset it, to potentially offset it. You had Brian Fitzpatrick say the other day, well, I thought I had up to 40 in August. Now it's all kind of jumbled up with reconciliation and, you know, my guys don't want it linked. So I don't know if I still have that. I got to go do my whip count again. And that was several days ago and I haven't heard any fresh numbers. So do Republicans feel like these things are, in effect linked because the legislative drafting process is moving forward in earnest?
Yeah.
Or they say Democrats can't figure out what to put in this thing. It's not baked. And this bipartisan bill is baked. I can more comfortably vote on this now knowing that this is truly delinked from the other bill.
I would also say, Bill, like normally I'm against political gamesmanship and I see it as very destructive. But in this case, you know, it would make sense to me, like if I'm a Republican and I might have voted for the bipartisan bill a few months ago, let's make the Democrats actually pass, like, you know, muster enough votes to pass it. Like, they've got the majority. They're, you know, this is their president, their bill. Like, why would I want to come and rescue them politically at this moment?
Well, I think that the tough calculation of Republicans is if they said, we're not going to help, we're going to sit on our hands and we're going to try to maximize Democrats in disarray. That could have the opposite effect where Democrats say, hey, we're trying to be bipartisan here. Now you guys, you know, we set up a standalone vote. We got this deal linked. You moved the goalpost. You're being disingenuous now. Forget this whole deal. We can do the whole kit and caboodle and reconciliation without you. We're trying to do you a favor. You can go home and say you got some roads and bridges in your districts. Now forget it. You know, Democrats, if they can get their own ducks lined up, have the power to do that. They have the numbers to do that if they can reach their own consensus. And that might be easier if Republicans move the goalposts. And furthermore, if Republicans cooperate and pass the infrastructure bill, that gives the moderates more leverage. There no longer is the infrastructure bill being held hostage. And so if they want to say, look, we want to see that this bill be reduced in size as much as possible, I'm now giving the moderates more of the whip hand to do that if I get this infrastructure bill to Biden's desk. So, but I don't know if that's what they're thinking is going to be, but I think that is a reasonable calculation to make.
You feel like this shirt's too green?
This is your lucky shirt, right?
This is a shirt that I wore on Bill Maher many years ago, right, and aroused controversy. And I think there's something about it that, like, on with lights on camera, it looks like much brighter than everything else. So, oh, who do we have here? Mr. Jingles?
It's Mochi. It's Mochi. Mochi is a fluffy cat. It's not. When you put the face right in the camera, you don't really get to see very much. Anywho.
Well, I probably have to bolt early today to get back to writing, but a couple other things happened this week, right? You've got the Nicki Minaj tweet.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting. If you take that in the AOC dress, you could really ask, like, how serious are we as a society?
Well, you know, and Tucker then brought on Jim Brewer, you know, America's treasure, Jim Brewer, who was complaining that he wasn't going to do shows if at venues that mandated vaccinations. And
there you go.
I can't say either celebrity is my guiding light for public health concerns.
Which brings us to the actual big news of the week, the death of Norm MacDonald.
I'm going to try to be respectful in this moment, Matt Lewis. So I want to try to be respectful in this moment, Matt Lewis. I don't want to be rude or insensitive, but he was not my favorite SNL performer. I'll just say that.
I'm listening to his audiobook now, mm-hmm. which he narrates and is quite good so far, I can tell you.
Mm-hmm. I understand it's a little different now that we know that he had cancer and he passed.
Yeah, and it's very deep. It's a lot deeper and introspective than I would have thought. I can tell you, I remember seeing his movie Dirty Work, like loving the commercial and the concept. You know, you hire these guys to like do your dirty work for you.
Did you see Dirty Work?
What's that?
Did you see Dirty Work?
I did see Dirty Work it came out, and I remember being very disappointed that it wasn't that good. But I always generally liked him. But I didn't understand the level of like love that some people had for him. I always liked him, thought he was funny, but that he just didn't quite didn't quite rise to the occasion.
I mean, maybe it's not the time for a deep searing critique of the Norm MacDonald, you know, canon. You know, I think he had always had a hard go because he, I guess he was after Kevin Nealon on Weekend Update. It was Dennis Miller, Kevin Nealon, Norm Macdonald. You know, Kevin Nealon wasn't that great on Weekend Update either. You know, Dennis Miller is like your pinnacle for Weekend Update, and just kept going down, you know, from there. And I think people rightly credit Norm Macdonald for being brutal on O.J. Simpson in Weekend Update segments. And, you know, there's a sort of different analysis. I think he was arguing that he got fired because he was being mean to O.J. and the NBC executive was friends with O.J., whereas the other story is that he just thought the guy wasn't that funny, period, and fired him for that reason. You certainly can't fault the guy for being harsh on O.J., but I don't think it was the strongest Weekend Update anchor overall. He has a certain acerbic quality where, like, deployed in the right circumstance really hits the mark. But didn't always hit the mark.
It was like a David Letterman sort of dry humor. I don't know how to describe it otherwise, but I liked him. And I will say, I mean, I'm still in the first few chapters, but the audiobook is quite good. And I think that's the way to go with his narration as opposed to just reading it. It's a very interesting memoir.
Now, I assume that your Norm Macdonald fan, generally speaking, leans to the right. He was kind of a politically incorrect comic. One clip I saw being passed around, like, you know, this amazing Norm Macdonald clip on The View, and I watched the clip, and he's like, he's calling Bill Clinton a murderer. He's just saying, as like a matter of fact, everyone's like, no, he is not a murderer. He's like, really? I heard he was a murderer. I heard that was established. I'm like, this is
well,
not
I think a- that, I think to the degree it's funny, it's that he goes all in and is shocked that there's pushback.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? It's the commitment to the gag.
But I'm watching, like, it's not clear whether this is a gag or if he actually is a good conspiracy theorist, or some combination of the two. The fact that he went there on those types of subjects, I'm sure is endearing to a certain stripe of conservative.
Here's the thing though. I feel like, I mean, there's a couple things at play here. One, I feel like every young in their prime person in Hollywood or New York is a progressive. Like Dennis Miller, the aforementioned Dennis Miller, the arguably the greatest host of Weekend Update, was like a liberal back when he mattered.
Certainly more so than today.
Well, it's like people always find Jesus when they hit rock bottom. The same thing with Ronald Reagan. Like they find conservatism after it's like a second act. Like, you know, Jim Brewer, I'm guessing that when Half Baked came out, like in 1998, that Jim Brewer was but the whole definition of conservative has changed. You know what I mean? Like, so it's hard for me. There's sort of two things going on. One is that I think Trump has changed the entire dynamic and that there are people today who are on the conservative side, but they don't like believe in Edmund Burke or Hayek or anything like that. But then the other thing is that people, as their careers go on and they fall out of, so like, I guess this is a long way of saying, like, back in the 90s, Norm Macdonald probably would not have been considered conservative, right? Like, I think that people who heard his comedy would have said, like, that is, if you're a conservative and you heard his comedy back then, you would have like thought that it was like, crude and perverse and unconservative, and that liberals probably liked him better back then, right?
Well, I just don't think Norm Macdonald, you know, like in the 90s had a great fan base. I think he had kind of a, over time, developed something that was more, I think he built a fan base over time in the aftermath of that, bit by bit, going on talk shows, going on Conan, going on Letterman. And he also, I think people did like the Turd Ferguson character, the Burt Reynolds Turd Ferguson character in Celebrity Jeopardy. But I don't think he had the same kind of fan base that Dennis Miller had. And, you know, Miller, you know, was generally going after conservative targets on Weekend Update. And I don't think did too much in a politically incorrect vein then. There's two Miller memories I have. One was neither actually on Weekend Update. One was during on Comedy Central. There was like a live State of the Union play-by-play thing. And this is when the Republicans took over the House in 95. And Dennis Miller was there was like a pan out to the whole of the House. And Miller said, "It's like the elders from Footloose. Let the kids dance." And also around that time, actually, I guess it was actually 92. I actually saw Miller live. It was on a bill with Spade and Jon Stewart. And Miller was all in for Ross Perot in his stand-up act. That was the exact kind of crazy that I want sitting in the Oval Office. So it was at a point where like you weren't sure if really meant it or not, or it was just a joke. But of course, seeing where he went from there, now I look back, it's like it definitely wasn't a joke. He definitely was a Ross Perot guy. So I think he was moving, or he had this latent, you know, disrespect for Democrats early on, but just hadn't really manifested in full until later on.
So I think one of the things that Trump changed was I do think it used to be that like Hollywood, and I'm using like Hollywood as like the music industry. And I feel like there is more diversity now, like where let's go back to Nicki Minaj. Like she like tweeted like, I guess Tucker Carlson said something good about her or was supporting her anti-vaxxer stance.
Right.
And she like tweeted it out. You know what I mean? And like and people were pushing back like he's a white supremacist. Mm. And she like tweeted something. It's hard for me to understand exactly what she means when she tweets anything because it's very cryptic. But I took it to be her saying like, I'm not beholden to either political party, man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that was my interpretation. It was kind of hard to put it together, but that's what I think she was saying. And I do think that one consequence, look at Kanye West would be another example. Like for better or worse, I think there's like more diversity now. You know, when the Republican Party was like a Mike Pence party, it was easier. Ironically, it was easier to make fun of Republicans for Hollywood than Trump is sort of them in some ways. So it's an interesting dynamic. Well, I don't know what it has to do with Norm MacDonald.
Was more that I'm uncomfortable talking with Norm MacDonald at this moment in time. But I think we've talked about this before, you know, conservatives hate celebrity politicians until they're on their side. And now any celebrity that's being vax skeptic is being embraced by right wing skeptics. Like Tucker Carlson, who's probably vaccinated himself for all I know. But he clearly is pushing that line publicly and has no hesitation bringing on a Jim Brewer, who is obviously not a, you know, you're back in the day. Why are we listening to these celebrities? They don't know anything. They aren't experts. They should go shut up and play basketball. They should go show up and do their movies. Jim Brewer is not Anthony Fauci. He's not a doctor. He's not a public health expert, but by all means, bring him on and pontificate about vaccines. By all means, bring on Nicki Minaj, who's been rebutted by the health officials in Trinidad and Tobago, where this testicle swelling incident allegedly happened. But ignore what the officials have to say. Let's just listen to the celebrity mouth off.
Speaking of Bill, somebody made this point earlier, but I think it was kind of profound. They took a picture of John McLaughlin, you know, from the McLaughlin group. Mm-hmm. And they tweeted, "Issue one, the cousin's friend's balls. Where does the story go from here? Pat Buchanan." And it was a brilliant tweet because you can't imagine the McLaughlin group doing a segment on this. And it just shows you how absurd and insane our political discussion has become that, you know, even a show, which I think the McLaughlin group was derided at the time, for being like, you know, superficial mm-hmm. or something. And now it's like you can't imagine that they would lower themselves to have the discussion that you and I are now yeah. having.
I mean, you may recall the legendary SNL McLaughlin Group sketch, since we'll bring us all back to SNL as much as possible. You know, and I can watch that sketch, you know, 1,000 times, and I certainly have. You know, the sketch starts with them talking about NAFTA and the ascension of John Major to the British Prime Minister's position over Margaret Thatcher. Because it was true to the show. It was true that those are the kinds of topics that the McLaughlin would talk about, even if they did it in a bombastic and superficial way. And then, of course, it descends into lunacy. But, you know, cable TV in general has, you know, there probably isn't all that much discussion of step up in basis happening on cable TV right now, even though that's a pretty major development in the sausage making process. You know, celebrities and testicles are going to, you know, crowd that out every time in our current media landscape.
Wrong! Eleanor Cliff! well, that's why people come here, Bill. They come here for both discussion about swollen testicles and the wonkery of, I don't know, the inheritance tax and capital gains and whatever, like, mystical dark arts you engage in with the wonkery over there.
Well, we should probably wrap things up. What do you got to plug this week?
Oh, I just had Katie Herzog. Do you know her, Bill?
I don't know her, actually. I saw you plug in the podcast, but I don't know her.
Yeah. So she's a really interesting. She was a reporter with the Stranger, which is a very alternative.
Oh, I think I do know her. Yeah.
Yeah. She's controversial.
Yeah. Bill.
She's a lesbian that people call anti-trans. Mm-hmm. So we just had a discussion about Nicki Minaj and AOC that was a little different than this. She revealed during our discussion that she was a member of an all-girls fight club in college. So definitely check that out. I need to post the audio. Bill, you know I have a YouTube page where I put the videos, some of these videos mm-hmm. up, so people could go and subscribe there if they want. I think this is youtube.com/Matt Lewis. The audio will be up later.
You know, before Tuesday, I wrote a piece for the Washington Monthly about the Boston mayoral race. They had their preliminary on Tuesday. And progressive candidate Michelle Wu came out on top, and a more moderate candidate, Anissa Asabi George, I'm sure I'm pronouncing her last name wrong, came in second. Three African-American candidates actually came in third, fourth, fifth, including the acting mayor, Kim Janey. But it's a very unusual field in Boston. We had no white men. I mean, there's never been a non-white man. What's that?
It's not a big college town.
There's never been a non-white male elected mayor. We have an acting mayor in Boston who's an African-American woman because Marty Walsh was the labor secretary.
Let me just say that's a Spinal Tap joke about Boston. It has nothing to do with the fact that only white men go to college. Because as we just learned from the Wall Street Journal, they don't, actually.
Well, I mean, you know, my piece in the Monthly was basically saying, you know, Wu has got the inside track here because she is the candidate for college-educated Boston, which is at least half of the Boston, a little less than half of the Boston population, and perhaps more than half of the Boston electorate. And she is not Boston born and bred. She's Chicago born, Harvard grad, Harvard law, Elizabeth Warren protege. So the kind of person that Eric Adams in New York would call a fancy candidate, and he said, we don't want fancy candidates. Well, in Boston, they might well want a fancy candidate because it's a very highly educated population and a much more diverse population than it was 20 years ago. It's a majority-minority city. I don't think she's a lock because Asabi George certainly can play some moderate cards and try to win the votes of, you know, older Boston. But if you read my article – if you want to catch up on the race, even though it was written the day before, it still will give you a good lay of the land of what the rest of the race is going to look like. And I have a piece coming up in the Monthly soon about this capital gains tax stuff and the road for tax reform and reconciliation.
Eat the rich. Final thoughts.
We're going to Zoom tomorrow or not?
I think we're off tomorrow.
Okay, well, I might do a solo Zoom then.
Okay. Just be prepared for the 40 minute short stuff.
You know, I paid for the premium Zoom, so I can go for an hour now.
You're not going to need me anymore, Bill. Pretty soon you're going to launch your own empire. It's going to be called Shareable. But you can do that, right? If people want to participate, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/BillShare.
That's right. That's right.
And they can participate. Or our joint ones would be patreon.com/MattLewis. Either. You could be in on those. So.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you next week.
All right. Have a good one. And follow us on Twitter @DMZ Show. See you in the DMZ next week.
Take care.